welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I am Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, we continue our Mars series with the latest news about the Mars 2020 rover Perseverance. And a poem about Mars. Then Robert Zubrin puts forth his ideas about getting humans to Mars. And an anthem for Mars, courtesy of the Mars Society. Next up, we're going to have Space Show News. Well, heading out now, away from the Earth a little. On February the 27th, a 100-gram sample from the Moon went on public display at the National Museum of China in Beijing. The sample was taken from the nearly 2 kilograms of rock and soil brought back from the Moon by the Chang'e 5 mission. Also on display is the Chang'e 5 return capsule and parachute, as well as life-size models of its ascender and lander. A model of the Tianwen-1 Mars rover is also being shown. Now, after a residency of indeterminate duration, the exhibition will tour China, but don't count on it coming here to Australia. Last week, the China National Space Administration released 3 high-definition images of Mars taken by the Tianwen-1 spacecraft. The 2 panchromatic and 1 coloured image were taken from a distance of about 330 kilometres above Mars. They show features as small as 700 millimetres, clearly visible are small craters, ridges and dunes. In May or June, a 240 kilogram rover will separate from Tianwen-1 and descend to the Martian surface. That rover has not yet been named. It has 6 wheels and 4 solar panels and carries 6 scientific instruments. Superficially, it looks like the Mars exploration rovers that landed on Mars in 2004 from the United States. Now, if the landing is successful, the rover will be able to autonomously drive at 200 meters per hour.
On FM, online, and on TuneIn, 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
And now we're going to head into our Mars section. A.V. Christie has a little thing here called Atmosphere. It's about observing Mars, and there's an introduction by the poet. And note, there's an error in this. He says Mars has an atmosphere of sulfuric acid. Well, no, it doesn't. It has an atmosphere of carbon dioxide. It's the planet Venus that has sulfuric atmosphere in its atmosphere. Here we go, Atmosphere by A.V. Christie.
This poem really looks at that one moment where you decide to call something a fissure or a canal. Mars looks so beautiful in this one year. It was very up close to us, and it had this gorgeous color. And then, you know that it's made of sulfuric acid up close, you know, just the just a very harsh planet. So those contrasts were very much in my mind. Atmosphere. The canals of Mars beseech various oxides, vast dust storms of a dulled red, a daytime warmth that only reaches so far. Let's call these fissures canals, so we'll think of Venice, looking through our telescope as Mars comes this close in this our anniversary year with its thin atmosphere and, to be probed, its extreme cold.
Robert Zubrin is no stranger to the Space Show. We, in fact, had him on last week. He is president of Pioneer Astronautics, which is in Lakewood, Colorado, And he's also one of the big movers and shakers in the Mars Society. He has some very distinct ideas about how we might get humans to Mars. He disagrees with the way that many of the space agencies are trying to do it. Well, he was speaking at RMIT University in 2015, and I'll give you a little warning. We were taking the feed off his radio microphone, but unfortunately the RMIT technician left on the lectern microphone, which not only captured the ambient sound, but also Zubrin whenever he was near the lectern. So the sound is a little variable on this, but here we go to RMIT and Robert Zubrin.
It took 8 months for that to fly to Mars. It took 10 months to make the propellant. That's 18 months. We got 26 months in between launch windows. So long before the next launch window opens up, year three, we will know that we have a fully fueled Earth return vehicle sitting waiting for us on the Martian surface. That being the case, in year three, we can launch two more boosters off the Cape. And one shoots out another one of these Earth return vehicle fuel factory combinations. The other shoots out a habitat with a crew of four astronauts in it. Now, because our return ride is waiting for us on the surface of Mars, we don't need to fly to Mars in a gigantic Death Star spaceship. We don't even need to fly to Mars in a comparatively modest Millennium Falcon. No, we can fly to Mars in a Tunican. And this is a very fortunate development because we know how to build tuna cans, and they've been proven very effective for packaging in general commerce. Okay, now, of course, our tuna can is somewhat larger than the standard chicken of the sea model. This one is about 8 meters in diameter and 5 meters tall, so it's got two decks, each with about 2.5 meters of headroom. The upper deck is where the people live. The lower deck is more of a garage, workshop, cargo hold kind of place. This is one potential layout of the upper deck of the hab where the people live. And what you see here is science area, exercise area, little stateroom for each of the four astronauts, the wardroom, galley area. And then in the center here is a solar flare storm shelter. Now, this is worth talking about for a couple minutes. Radiation, you hear a lot about it as a potential showstopper for Mars missions. It isn't. There's ways to deal with it. Okay, first of all, there's two kinds of radiation that can get you in interplanetary space. There's cosmic rays and there's solar flares. And they're totally different from each other. Solar flares come from, let's not all see the same hands all the time. The sun, yes, correct. All right, so, solar flares come from the sun, and they come in an unpredictable way. You get a big one maybe once a year, although you could have two inside of the same month and nothing for 2 years, but to first approximation, it's about a one-a-year affair. You get more during solar max than solar min, but once again, it could happen any time in principle. And you get this big flare of radiation from the sun, which in the course of several hours could deliver several thousands rem of radiation, or several tens of sievarts, if you will, which is enough to kill either immediately or after a fairly brief period of radiation sickness. That's the bad news. The good news is that the kind of radiation that solar flares are made of is protons with energies of about 1 million volts each. And that kind of stuff can be stopped by 12 centimeters of water, or things that from a nuclear point of view are essentially the same thing as water, such as food, or things that water and food become as the mission proceeds. And we have enough of that to pack it in around a limited central area of the ship, okay, And if a solar flare happens, the alarm bell rings, everybody goes into that pantry storm shelter, and they're stuck in there for a few hours until the all clear rings and they come out. And that's how they're safe against the solar flare. Now, the other kind of radiation, though, is something else entirely. It's called cosmic rays. Now, cosmic rays don't come from the sun. They come from the cosmos, yes. Actually, no one even knows where in the cosmos they come from or how they could come from anything, because they've got energies not of millions of volts each, but billions of volts each, which defies current physics in that nuclear reactions can't produce particles that energetic. But nevertheless, these particles do exist. They come zipping into our solar system from interstellar space, and with energies of a billion volts each, which is three orders of magnitude more than a solar flare particle. And therefore, you can't stop them with 12 centimeters of water. It needs meters of water shielding to stop cosmic rays. And we don't have that much mass available to us on the ship. So the bad news is we are going to take that dose. The good news is the dose isn't that big. Okay, first of all, it's not a big rush now and then. It's just a constant pitter-patter of high-energy radiation coming in from interstellar space. And the magnitude of the dose is predictable. It's about 60 rem, or 0.6 sievarts, if you will. A sievart is 100 rem. I'm not sure which system you use here. But anyway, which is about a 1% risk of getting cancer at some point later in your life. That is, getting a 60 rem dose does not have, especially scattered over 2.5 years, which is the case here. That is, it's about 60 rem per year. We're going to be in space a year on this mission, 6 months out, 6 months back. We're going to be on Mars for a year and a half. But on Mars, you have plenty of mass available for shielding. So the place where you get this dose is in transit. So you're getting the 60 rem scattered over 2.5 years. There would not be any apparent causal effect. What there would be was a statistical increase in your risk of getting cancer by about 1%. Now, that is not something that the health departments would recommend for the general public. But you have to put it in perspective. If you're an average citizen of an advanced country like Australia or the United States, you probably have about a 20, and you don't smoke, you have a 20% chance of getting cancer. Okay, this would make it 21. Okay, if you're an average American smoker, it's 40. So, in fact, if we recruited the crew out of smokers and sent them to Mars without their tobacco, you would be reducing their chance of getting cancer. Okay. So, therefore, one reason to send people to Mars would be for their health. Now, and I should mention, by the way, because once again, there are people beating the drums on this, either because they're radiation health effects researchers that want to get funding, or they're bureaucrats who don't want to do Mars missions and they want to wave this around as why they can't. But there are substantial cosmic ray doses on the space station. In fact, the cosmic ray dose rate on the space station is exactly half of what it is on the way to Mars, because the Earth's magnetic field does not block out cosmic rays. The Earth blocks out cosmic rays from half the sky if you're on the space station. Okay, but for the rest, you're getting the cosmic rays. So you're getting half the dose rate you'd get going to Mars. And as a result of that, there is about 10 astronauts and cosmonauts who have already received cosmic ray doses by being on the space station or the Mir or the Salyuts, that are quite comparable to what they would have gotten going to Mars and back. And there have been no radiological casualties in this group. Nor would you expect there to have been. Because if you got 10 people and they've each taken a 1% chance of getting hit, chances are no one's been hit. And no one has been. Okay. Eventually, we will see that. But it's, in other words, this is a risk we're already dealing with by just operating the space station. Now, there is, however, a deleterious health effect that has afflicted astronauts and cosmonauts in space that has shown serious repercussions, and that is zero gravity deconditioning. Okay. When you're in zero gravity for an extended period of time, your muscle and bone deconditions because you're not getting the same workout that even a very unathletic person just walking around on Earth gets because you're walking around and you're holding up 70 kilograms against the Earth's magnetic field all day long, or whatever it is for you. And so they decondition. Now, it is true that if people really work out on exercise machines on the space station, about 2 hours of hard workout a day, they can avoid most of these symptoms. But you need really disciplined crew members to keep that up, and it's wasting their time that they could be using on other things. So you really don't want to have to do that. So my solution is not to have zero gravity on the spaceship. My solution is to have artificial gravity, which we can create by, there's the HAB module. This is the upper stage of the Ares launch vehicle. It threw us to Mars, so it's gone to Mars too. We can use it as a counterweight on the other end of a tether. It's no longer a functional piece of hardware. It's used its fuel, but it's still got mass, and we can use this as a counterweight. We spin this up. You spin this at one revolution per minute, it creates Mars gravity in the HAB. If you spin it at about 1.7 revolutions per minute, it creates Earth gravity in the HAB. So by doing this, you can just avoid this whole problem. And I believe that that is appropriate. Not that you couldn't survive the mission otherwise. It's a six-month transit to Mars. 6 months is a standard rotation on the space station. And they all survive it, but they're deconditioned. And the thing is, once again, we want to be effective on Mars. So it's not a survival question. It's a mission effectiveness question. They're going to have to explore. Hiking around in a spacesuit, it's like heavy-duty backpacking. You got to have people in shape if they're going to do much of it. And therefore, we should send them in an appropriate way.
Robert Zubrin, speaking at RMIT University. And Robert is going to be back with another part of that talk he gave in 2015. More recently, he's been involved in making an anthem. Now, we had how that was written on last week's The Space Show. And here, Robert Zubrin gives us another take on the origins of this anthem, Rise to Mars. And then we have a performance of it by Oscar Castellino, who helped write the lyrics and the music. And Oscar comes from India. So why don't we hear Robert Zubrin and Oscar Castellino?
I don't know, about 5 months ago or so, I don't know the exact date, I was contacted out of the blue by a gentleman named Oscar Castellino, and he said, "Hi, I want to help you get humans to Mars. How can I help? I'm an opera singer." And I said, "Okay, we can use an anthem. Something, you know, no movement has ever gotten anywhere without music. And you know, I want it to be grand, but I want it to be a song that is singable, okay, by people with average voices. In other words, it can't be the Queen of the Night, you know? And it has to be something that people can sing. It has to be a Marseillaise for Mars." Because, you know, Roget de Lisle composed the Marseillaise in, I think, 1792. And the young Napoleon Bonaparte heard it sung for first time by the regiment from Marseille as they entered Paris. And you know, he said to the composer, you know, "Monsieur, your song is worth 20 regiments." And it is, at least, considerably more. Anyway, we need our own Marseillaise. And so Oscar set about composing it to both make it grand but singable, and I think he succeeded in that. And he wrote some words, which were pretty good, but then I helped him a bit with the words. I have some credit on helping on the words. And then it was arranged for both piano and orchestra by James Welland, who is right here as well. And it was performed by the Royal Welsh Symphonia Orchestra. It was great, and they performed it in Bombay or someplace like that, and it was great. And they're here tonight to perform it. But and I want you to listen really carefully, because after that, you're going to have an opportunity to perform it too. The music, sheet music's right on the tape. All right, so without further ado, Oscar Castellino and James Welland in Rise to Mars.
Make this desert come alive.
Well, they obviously have a great time there at the Mars Society. That was Oscar Castellino leading on with the, now was now the theme music or the anthem for the Mars Society, Rise to Mars. We're going to rejoin Robert Zubrin after these messages.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
And now on the Space Show, we return to RMIT University, where Robert Zubrin gave a talk about his ideas on how to get humans to Mars.
They are flying out to Mars on a six-month trajectory, which is a little faster than minimum energy. Minimum energy is the eight-month trajectory. Why 6 months? Well, a couple of reasons. One is, if you turn on the propellant, you give it a little extra push, you can get there in 6 months, and it doesn't cost you that much to shorten the mission by that much. If you try to shorten it substantially more than that, the propellant requirements to achieve shorter trips start really hurting you. And what that means is, for the same mass, you're carrying a lot less payload, and you're probably not improving crew safety at all, because while the trip is shorter, the systems that are supporting the crew are thinner. Okay, but why 6 months as opposed to 6.2 months or 5.7 months or something like that? Well, it's this, is that the six-month orbit to Mars has got a special characteristic. It's the free return orbit. That is, if you're on your way to Mars and you decide to chuck a Huey, you don't want to go to Mars. You can fly past Mars and you go out to about 2 astronomical units away from the sun, and then you come around back, and you will get back to 1 astronomical unit from the sun, that is to say the Earth's distance from the sun, exactly 2 years after you left, which means the Earth will have gone around exactly twice, and it will be there to meet you, which is convenient. If, in fact, you tried to go to Mars faster than the six-month trajectory, and you went past Mars instead of going to Mars, you would go further out than 2 AU, and therefore you'd come back, it would take you longer to get back. You might get back to Earth's orbit at, say, 2.3 years or something of this sort, which means the Earth wouldn't be there, and you have failed in your free return. If you tried to go to Mars slower, you'd get back sooner than 2 years, and once again, you would fail in your rendezvous with the Earth. So the six-month orbit is the free return orbit, and therefore it is the uniquely correct orbit for transits of the human expedition. The cargoes can go out in 8 months. It doesn't matter. They're not going to do free return. But and by going in 8 months, you get a bit more cargo. But the people should go out in 6 months. And that means, by the way, that people who are pushing advanced propulsion so you can get to Mars faster are making a simply incorrect argument. I mean, some of them, like Franklin Chang Dewis, who claims he can, his Vasimir system can get people to Mars really quick, are just liars, because it can't. Okay, but others, like people pushing nuclear thermal propulsion, which is a superior propulsion system that could get you to Mars in 5 months or so without excessive mass penalties, you wouldn't want to use it for that purpose. Instead, if you had a superior propulsion system like nuclear thermal propulsion, you would still go on the six-month trajectory, and you'd take advantage of the superior propulsion performance to increase your payload. That's what you would do. Anyway, they're on a six-month trajectory to Mars. They get close, and when they arrive, they fire a pyrotechnic device that cuts the cable, so the upper stage and cable go away into interplanetary space, and then they go sledding on in, aero capture into Mars orbit, and then after checking out the weather, they go and land at landing site number 1, where the fully fueled Earth return vehicle is waiting for them. Now, we've been on the ground at landing site number one for 2 years. We thoroughly explored the area with little robotic rovers that photographed everything. We got a radar beacon on the ground that can draw them in, just like the one at the airport. We got an ace fly in this thing. We should be able to land right on the spot. X marks the spot. You are there. Land accurately at the site of the Earth return vehicle. That's what should happen. But let's say it doesn't. Let's say they land 50 kilometers off course, 100 kilometers off course, 200, which would be a massive landing error. We're still okay, because we have with us in the lower deck of the HAB a pressurized ground roving vehicle about the size of a little SUV that runs on a methane oxygen engine, and it has a one-way range of 1,000 kilometers. So it would really take piss-poor piloting to land outside of the reach of such a vehicle. But let's say that happens. Let's say instead of landing there or there or there, you know, they land here on the wrong side of the planet. This would represent a serious problem with the pilot selection process at NASA. Now, if that happened, if they landed on the wrong side of the planet, we can still save the mission because we got the other Earth return vehicle following us out to Mars. And if necessary, it could be brought down to land near us in any location you like. Okay. Now, in that case, we would be depending upon the chemical synthesis gear to work in real time instead of in past time, which is the basis of the mission. However, the success of the technology has already been demonstrated by the success of the first lander, and you do have a human crew on the scene to adjust the chemical synthesis equipment should it malfunction while they are there. Although in this example, you would not want the pilot to participate in that activity. But you still have three other people you could use. Now, if all that fails, if you can't land accurately, if you can't drive there, if you can't use the second ERV, what else do you got? Well, you've got the crew landed on Mars. They've got natural gravity. They've got substantial radiation protection available from the Martian environment. And they got enough supplies with them to last for 3 years. So that if worse comes to worse, they can just tough it out on the surface of Mars until 2 years later, when another Earth return vehicle and another habitat could be fired out to them at that time. So what you have is a four-layer defense in depth on the mission that all involve carrying off the mission as well as one abort option. Okay. But, of course, if things work out as it should, they land at site number one. What do we do with the second Earth return vehicle? Well, we land it somewhere else. In principle, could be anywhere else. It could be just over the hill. It could be on the other side of the planet. I prefer to land it a few hundred kilometers away. Why? Because it's going to define the site of the next human expedition, which we do want to explore someplace new. On the other hand, I would like to have it still within at least one-way driving range of my available ground transportation, so that if worse comes to worse, if, for instance, the Earth return vehicle checks out fine now but somehow goes bad in the course of the mission, the crew still has the second Earth return vehicle that they could go home in. So they are multiply backed up. They have two complete Earth return vehicles, either one of which can take them home. They have three habitable volumes, the big one in the HAB plus the two Earth return vehicle cabins. But the main purpose of the second Earth return vehicle is not for them, but to be the destination of the next human mission, which will fly there in year 5, along with another Earth return vehicle, which is their backup, but which otherwise opens up site number 3. So the idea here is every 2 years, you launch two boosters to Mars, one to exploit a previous site, the other to open up a new site. Two boosters every 2 years is an average of one per year. When we were flying shuttles in a serious way, we are flying 6 a year. So you're talking about using 1/6 of your heavy lift capability to support this program, which means you could do other things in parallel, including lunar missions, asteroid missions, other things that require heavy lift. I think that as long as we have a human spaceflight program using 1/6 of its heavy lift capability to actually explore space is entirely reasonable. So this is an actual photograph of the Mars base. Okay, so here is the Earth return vehicle. There's the cabin, the two propulsion stages, the chemical plant in the landing stage, which is the takeoff pad for the rest of it, the reactor in the crater in the background, power comes in on this wire. Here is the habitation craft, upstairs where they live, downstairs is the garage for the little exploration vehicle, some solar panels in case you got to turn the reactor off, that you got some backup power. We also have backup power by running the engine of the car or the light truck, which is probably hard for you to see right now, but it's sitting right over there. This is an inflatable greenhouse. This is not a mission critical element. It's an experiment in learning how to grow crops on Mars in Martian soil, Martian water, Martian gravity, Martian sunlight for the benefit of future missions and future bases.
Robert Zubrin, the president of Pioneer Astronautics, he comes from Lakewood, Colorado, speaking at RMIT University. And he's going to be back on the Space Show next week with more of his ideas. Well, just about time to, we've just got time to have a little poem by, read by Judith Vinnell, from our very own Southern FM's Judith Vinnell, and this is a Mars sonnet.
Shall I compare thee to a Martian day? Thou art 37 minutes longer and colder. Gentle winds may loft your dusty display. During your summer I would never smoulder. Always too intense the radiation does shine, even when the clouds may cause it to dim. Storms and dust devils appear to align, seen from orbit, limb to limb. This red majesty can never fade, iron bound to oxygen, the indubitable rust. A sign of past oceans and atmosphere forbade, broken magnetic fields trust. So long as humans and robots can see, so long you will always fascinate me. Fred Califf, JPL, data scientist, geologist.
Thank you, Judith. Nicely read there. Well, we're just about out of time here on the Space Show. More about Mars on next week's show. And just remember, you can get in contact with the Space Show by going to space.asn.au, space.asn.au. Coming up shortly will be Nick Black and Purple Haze.